I'm Jonathan Bastian. This week on KCRW's Life Examined, whether it's a peaceful walk in the woods, the shade of leaves, or protection from the elements, trees are so much a part of our lives. But their true ability to amaze might be the way they communicate and help each other.
The tree is standing head down. The real head or brain of the tree are the root tips. So there the tree makes decisions. There is a lot of communication with the surrounding species in the soil and between the trees of the same, let's say, family.
And later, forget hiking and rushing through a forest. Why slowing down and being still amongst the trees might be far more beneficial.
There's this overwhelming calmness and well-being that I get when I'm among trees. I just feel like I'm among friends, that when I walk through a forest, I feel like I'm sort of walking into a warm hug.
Forest bathing and the hidden, surprising life of trees, all ahead on KCRW's Life Examined. The trees and forests have long been a source of inspiration for art and poetry. Today, the modern environmental movement calls their, quote, leafy canopies the vanguard in fighting global climate change by absorbing CO2 and cooling the planet. Old mature trees and forests are of greatest value, and their biggest threat and ours is deforestation. Perhaps you've seen the images of hundreds of thousands of clear-cut acres of Amazon rainforest. But trees have been here a long time and have learned to collaborate and help each other, developing a sophisticated social network. German forester and author of The Hidden Life of Trees, What They Feel, How They Communicate, Peter Wallieben, says the brain of a tree lies in its roots. Because trees can't move, they use their roots to communicate, to make decisions, and even to store memories. His latest book is called The Heartbeat of Trees, Embracing Our Ancient Bond with Forests and Nature. It contains the latest science and research, but his message is simple. Those age-old ties linking humans to the forest are alive and well. We just have to know where to look. Peter Wallieben, it's a pleasure to have you on Life Examined. Welcome.
Thank you, Jonathan, for the invitation.
I want to talk about some of your earlier research, which describes trees as social creatures. It's something that I find so fascinating in your work. Can you introduce us to this idea of how a tree can be social?
Yeah, I think it surprises many people. But on the other hand, that's a principle of nature that cooperation is better than competition. And trees are so much older than we are. And often we think, Peter Wohleben is anthropomorphizing trees, but it's the other way around. We have developed very much later than trees, and we have the same principles. So that means, for example, that trees know, a single tree know, I'm not a forest, and just as a forest, I'm able to cool down. For example, trees are able to cool down the local climate around about 15 degrees by sweating together. For example, a big broadleaf tree is able to gas out as much as 500 liters of water per day, and that's cooling the local climate. There's much more rain over such forest, and that all just works when trees work together as a forest, as a social community.
Wow. And there's so many interesting examples in this. You talk about trees, how they're able to nurse a sick neighbor, a tree that's not doing as well. It can be helped by others. Is that right?
That's right. And I discovered that around about 25 years ago when I stumbled upon an old stump. And this stump, the tree has been felled around about 400 years ago and was still alive without any green leaf. And a tree burns sugar in its cells, so it needs energy. It needs fresh sugar from photosynthesis. And without any green leaf, that's not possible. And how could this tree survive 400 years, this stump? And the only explanation was that the surrounding trees were feeding this tree, nursing this tree, this stump. I'm always talking about a tree because the real tree is in the underground. What we see above, it's just for getting nutrition. And then as a forester, I was trained to look at trees as competitors. And I, as a forester, was the referee, and when the two trees were struggling, I could cut one tree down and say, okay, I'm the referee, and you get now more space, the remaining tree. And in reality, it's a destruction of the social community. And with this old stump, I learned that the trees are cooperative.
And for them, what's the point of forming these communities? I think you alluded a little bit to the aspect of, you know, we're better together than we are alone, something like that.
Exactly. A tree wants to become very old because a tree is very slow and it takes decades, if not centuries, to become grown up, to reproduce. And there are many dangers, and therefore they support each other. And when they start very slow in their youth, then they can become very, very old. That's also a principle by nature. And therefore, a tree childhood could last as long as 200 or 300 years. And then the tree with this very slow youth growth, it can become 1,000 years old, up to 10,000 years old, or even more. The oldest tree we know so far is around about 10,000 years old. This is the old lonely spruce tree in Sweden, in the Swedish mountains. But perhaps there are much older trees because there has to be done a lot of research on single trees.
We're most familiar seeing trees above ground and admiring them or cutting them down. But below them is this profound and amazing complex of fungal networks. How does that work? It's always amazed me when I've learned about it.
Yeah. First, I have to say that a tree is standing head down because the real head or brain of a tree are the root tips. There's a lot of research, for example, done here by the University of Bonn. In the root tips, there are brain-like structures. There are some molecules, signaling molecules, that are the same like in our brain. So there the tree makes decisions. There the tree stores its memory. And there is a lot of communication with the surrounding species in the soil and between the trees of the same, let's say, family. For example, they warn each other from bark beetle attacks, from fungi attacks, because there are also evil fungi which like to kill trees, from droughts, because one tree is recognizing this much earlier than other trees, depending on where it stands. So they are communicating a lot because they are so slow, and it's very important for them to know dangers in advance. And because the roots are not connecting every tree, the fungi network and this fungi filaments are very, very tiny. They are transporting the news on electrical and chemical ways, and therefore they are getting paid by the trees with sugar. And it can be up to 1/3 of the sugar production of a tree, which has to be paid to the fungal network. And therefore that you have an imagination how little this filaments are. On one teaspoon full of soil, forest soil, you can have a mile of fungi filaments.
I just want to make sure I understand this. The trees are almost compensating the fungi networks, in a sense, to pass these messages back and forth. Is that right?
That's exactly right. And it's a really expensive internet compared with the human internet. And it's very slow. But what interests me most when we research tree communication, in general, we can just discover things when trees are stressed by attacks or by weather conditions or whatsoever. I would be happy when one day a scientist would discover what trees are telling each other when they are happy, because that's really hard to prove.
The images you leave us with, this idea of the trees being head down, the metaphor or the thought of the roots as brain passing messages back and forth, it seems to me just a whole new paradigm of thinking about this, and frankly, one that's just completely filled with wonder.
And that are no metaphors. For us, it's hard to believe that plants are very much closer to us and to animals than we thought. I don't know if you know what the main difference between plants and animal is.
No.
It's the photosynthesis. It's the production of sugar. It's the fact that plants are able to produce their own food. That's the main difference. Because plants, they can't move. They stand where they are for their whole life long. Okay, but therefore, they have to have many, many more senses than we have. They have to make decisions. They have to have memories not to make the same mistake again and again. For example, we know that apple trees are able to count warm days in spring, because when they bring out their new leaves too early, then there could be a hard frost and destroy this new leaf. So a tree don't trust the first warm days in spring and wait and count. Okay, 1 day, 2 days, perhaps 10 or 20 days warm days, and then the tree say, okay, that's spring. And to count, a tree has to have a memory, because otherwise it would count every day new as one.
Is it too much of a stretch to say that a tree has a certain consciousness in the way that we think of humans being conscious beings?
Yeah, that's a difficult question, because no scientist, no biologist would say yes. We have here scientists in Germany who says, okay, yeah, okay, for that question you have to ask plants.
Okay.
But there are some hints that there is consciousness. For example, we know that plants and trees produce pain-suppressing substances. If pain is just a reflex, for example, when a tree is hurt by a bark beetle, then you can measure an electrical signal going through the tissue, then there's a reaction on this attack, but that could be just a reflex. But pain-suppressing substances, we produce that in situations of stress, for example, when we have an accident. Why do we produce pain-suppressing substances? Pain is a very, very important signal to react without thinking. And when we suppress it, it's very dangerous. But in some situations, we suppress it. Why? To stay conscious. And trees and plants are doing the same. So if a being produces pain-suppressing substances, then we can assume that there is a sort of consciousness. But many people say, oh no, that's going too far. And the reason why we react like this is, what else should we eat? But these questions are not scientific questions. It's okay to eat plants. It's okay to eat meat, although I'm a vegetarian, because I think meat is the main tree killer, forest killer. But even if plants are conscious about what they are doing, it's okay to eat them, because otherwise we would die and it's our right to survive.
Thinking about the levels of sophistication in these trees or tree networks, are there different degrees to that? Are certain, I don't know, deciduous trees more advanced in certain ways than other types of trees? Like, what's the differentiation you see as you go to different groves and see these different organisms?
We know that there are trees which like to be on their own. And so I assume that they are not so cooperative, that there is not so much communication. But that's just a guess. Many, many questions I have to answer with, I don't know. Because plants in general and trees are the last things which are going to be discovered. In detail, for example, that's a very new discovery, that trees have their immune system to defeat illness outside their roots, outside their body. And that's very untypical for beings. In general, for example, our immune system is in our body, and trees have it on the outer side with bacteria with which they cooperate. Or, for example, trees can also suffer from something similar like COVID-19, which is surprising. No one is thinking about virus diseases in trees, which are brought in here due to the global trade. So there are many, many things to discover. But and modern biologists say that the age of discovery for biology has just to begin.
Well, I think I want to now ask you just a little bit more of a personal question, which is, you've become a leading expert in trees. You've been able to communicate this to the masses. But for you, what initially drew you into these forests to dedicate your life to these things?
Yeah, when I was a child, I was more interested in animals. For example, I hatched a chicken on a heating pillow from my grandma because I read the experiments from Konrad Lorenz with the gray geese. Because when you talk to the chicken and the egg, the chicken thinks you are its mother. And when I was around about 10 years old, I thought, okay, I try this, and it worked. And it was really funny, but just for a few days, because afterwards you get very exhausted. You have always this little chicken around your feet, and to be careful not to step on it. And I did things like this because I was always curious how animals are working, how I could communicate with them. And after school, I thought about studying biology, and then I found out that it's also possible to become a forester. And then I made a mistake. I thought a forester is someone like a tree keeper.
Right.
But in reality, a forester is a little bit more like a tree butcher. And when I started forestry, I was told at university, yeah, it's okay to cut down trees because that helps the trees, that helps the forest to stay healthy and so on. That's not true, of course, but it's still being told at universities up today. And when I started forestry and cutting old beech trees down, for example, I felt in my heart something is wrong. And then I traveled around and looked at forest enterprises which worked environmentally friendly. And then I found out, okay, we don't need to help a forest. We have to let forests doing things on their own. Then they will stay healthy. And when we want to use timber, it's okay. But it's not okay for the trees. And we have to do it in the right balance. And I'm still figuring it out. What the right balance is, but that was my walk into the forest, and the turning point was the guided tours for the people I'm doing here in our forest academy, and the people said, for example, this tree is bended, and I said, that's a bad tree, because I thought it's a sawmill, I thought, okay, that will be bended planks, that is a worthless tree, and in reality, it's a wonderful tree. And with all those people, I learned to look at forest once again new. And then I talked a lot with scientists. We make research here in our forest up today. And then I began to explore the wonders of the forest. So it was not a very straight way.
I wonder for you, as you enter a forest now with this incredible amount of knowledge, and you think of the destruction of these incredible forests all across the globe. What goes into this idea now of removing beautiful old growth trees? I mean, is it almost kind of incomprehensible and immoral?
It's depending for which purpose people are doing this. If it is really necessary, then it's okay. But most forests, as I said, are destroyed for the meat production, to get more new meadows or soya plantations or whatsoever. Here in the forest where I'm responsible for, we protect this forest. And there's no tree going to be cut down anymore. And for me, it's very exhausting looking at all those bad managed forests. In Germany, for example, we have the biggest clear cuts ever made by the State Forest Commission, which is responsible for the protection of the forests. It's like in Brazil, in Germany, in the moment. It's really hard to see. And much of the timber is exported to the United States. That's also it's a global trade. In other years, we import a lot of timber from Canada, for example. So for me, the forestry which we experience today is getting harder and harder. And therefore, with my academy, we are working for the protection of the forest. We have lawyers which control the clear cuts, which are bringing the forest authorities to court. So for what is good for me, because I'm an optimist, even if it sounds like I'm a pessimist, I think we are very soon reaching a tipping point where we see that we have to do a lot more things for climate change, to preventing climate change. We have to do a lot more for restoring forests, for protecting old growth forests. And more people getting aware of that. And I think, in 1 or 2 years, we will see a lot of changes, positive changes.
Can you talk about the role of trees in climate change at large, both in terms of removing them, but the importance of keeping them too, to have some semblance of balance on the planet?
Most governments regard trees, the burning of wood, as carbon neutral. And that's very bad, because most of the scientists says that burning wood is worse than burning coal. But it is regarded to be carbon neutral, and therefore more and more power plants are changing from coal to wood. That's a bad development. For example, there's much wood from the southeastern United States burned in European power plants. But in terms of climate change, trees are the best, let's say, machines to take up carbon dioxide. Trees can cool down the landscape. Trees can create more rain, and that's exactly what we are experiencing. For example, you are on the West Coast. I read that the first wildfires appeared, meanwhile, around the year, and trees can change that. And therefore, we need more forest and we need more old trees. Most of the trees are too young, and just old trees are able to do all those benefits. And perhaps we would say, but it takes decades to let new forest grow. Yeah, but then let's start now with new forest. And let's reduce forestry. I wouldn't say we shouldn't have forestry, but we should have less timber consumption, we should have less stressful forests, we should have more protected forests, because they have so many benefits, as I said. For example, when I look at Germany, we have here now 1.5 degrees Celsius higher temperatures. That's more than the average rising world temperature, because we're a little bit far in the north. And when I think that in summer times, tree can cool down their surrounding area around about 15 degrees, mm-hmm. Then I would say, okay, where's the problem? And we have had 3 years of very heavy drought in summertime here in Germany, with many spruce plantations dying. But the old forest, the old broadleaf forest, like beech forest, oak forest, they are still fit. So I'm not concerned about nature. I'm concerned about us.
This is a question we deal with in California a lot, which is the dueling arguments of how much do you just try and clear out forests and old dead trees because they're considered to be tinder for fires. Yeah, versus leaving them in place, and I suppose many would say that's more of the natural path, that you know nature wouldn't be just sweeping out old trees. How do you fall on these arguments?
Yeah, I think that's a little bit crazy, because the forest you have in California, just a few of them are really old growth forest, and it depends on which sort of timber is remaining in the forest. When it's timber from thinning, lots of thin branches which dry out very fast, or thin stems which are drying out, or even clear cuts which are drying out, then you have a tinder or two for new fires. But old trees, old trunks which are on the ground, they store water like a sponge. And even if it is month of drought, those trunks are full of water and cooling their surrounding area. They are not burning. But with the old big trees over them, which are also cooling the surrounding air, you will at maximum see a ground fire. A ground fire you can see in California by nature, but not a wildfire burning the complete forest. And that is done by forestry, by land use changes. And now people say, okay, we have to clean up the forest and bring out all the branches out. And I would say, we need more old trees and we need less forestry.
Mm. So really more of keep what we have versus versus stripping away, which I think has been the argument. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And that's what we think. We think we can manipulate nature, but therefore we have to understand it. And no one can really say we have understood nature so far, because otherwise many people should have predicted what's 5 years ago, what's going on now. And for a minimum in Germany, I see that forest scientists, for example, are not able to see in the future for even just 3 years. So I think we should leave nature on its own wherever it is possible, and then we will have a better situation.
You talk about in your new book, the heartbeat of trees, that even though we feel that we are losing touch with nature, trees, through our phones, through the technology that we're using right now, that there is something that can be reclaimed and that it's still very much alive within us. I wonder if you can kind of bring us into some of the ideas that you're talking about in this new project.
We always, or in modern times, say, we have degenerated senses and we are so far away from nature, and that makes nature destruction more easier because we are on this side and nature is on the other side, but we are still within, and we see it in the very, on a very bitter way now in the COVID-19 pandemic, that we are still part of nature and the forces of nature, but there are also very nice ways of being connected. For example, when you walk in the forest, your blood pressure sinks. Your human system gets better. And that is caused because we are still connected. We are breathing in tree communication. And then our body reacts. Now we could say, okay, that is really strange. When our body realizes, we are in nature, we are in forest, especially, then our blood pressure gets better. But it's just the other way around. When you're going out of the forest, in your office, in your home, in the city, then your blood pressure is rising. And the blood pressure in the forest is the normal way. And what I love most is that our instincts, our body is so connected that you are reacting and you can measure it. I've done that with a TV host here in Germany. We were in the city of Cologne, in the inner city, and We measured the blood pressure, and then we went out in the forest and the blood pressure decreased. So everyone can experience that. And our conscious mind would say, that's nice here. I'm relaxing.
Yeah, it's funny. As we have this conversation, I've just returned from the Redwoods up past Santa Cruz, California. And it's just, I'm sure so many listeners can relate to that when you get in those old growth forests and the green and the quiet. I mean, there is something that's so meditative that just sweeps over you. It's kind of amazing.
Yeah, exactly. And why is it in those old forests? It's better in those old forests than in, let's say, younger pine forest, right? Mm-hmm. Why? Because the old forests are in a better balance and there's less stress communication between the trees. And you would say, wow, wonderful. And your body say, yeah, right. That's the right place to settle.
Yeah, exactly. There's this whole idea of forest bathing. I think that may be more popular in Japan, where you hear about this more often, but it's a term that is kind of moving around. What does forest bathing to you mean? What's the idea behind it?
The idea is that you allow yourself just to relax in the forest without having a schedule. That's okay. The idea behind. So nice. There are many different ways of forest bathing, but as educated grown-ups, we say, okay, we can't go into a forest without making a hike of, let's say, 15 miles. And we have to be there in the next restaurant or sightseeing point at noon and back at the car at, let's say, 5 p.m. or whatsoever. So we have a schedule. And when you make forest bathing, you allow yourself to lay 1 hour under a tree and looking up in the crown and seeing the clouds passing by and relaxing. And that's very hard to stand, to be honest. And therefore, we have trainers, not we, but in general, people who make forest bathing, they are trainers and they make some yoga with you or other exercises. And then when someone says, yes, you are allowed to relax without time pressure, and then you relax really. And that's all about forest bathing. So you can do it yourself with a tree in your garden or in the next city park. All you have to do is to take your time without pressure.
What do you think the impacts of a good forest bath are?
What we know from scientists is that your blood pressure gets in better condition for days, that your human system is getting better conditions for days. So it doesn't matter if you're just 1 or 2 hours out in the forest or 1 or 2 days. I would say once a week would be a nice schedule, and perhaps in between, in daytime at noon, make a little nap under a tree. That is very good for your health. We know that trees in cities lengthen your lifespan. When you have enough trees in the city, then your lifespan will be more than 1 year longer.
Yeah, I mean, there is this idea more and more of kind of nature deprivation as almost an illness or something that can remove years to your life. That's something I take that you believe in as well.
And we know that, for example, when you're in a hospital, you need less painkillers when you look at a tree. That's a psychological phenomenon, of course, but it works. So some hospitals are constructed differently and have parks outside because you get healthier or you recover faster. So trees are very important for our health, and therefore it's, yeah, and how we treat the forest in the moment, it's like a mirror. When we treat forests better, we treat ourselves better.
I wonder if you could do a small experiment. I mean, imagine we could walk into a forest, and you could give us a sense of how to be in it, what to look for, what to experience. What would that be like?
First, I would say close your eyes. Don't look, because we concentrate very much too much on our eyes. Perhaps you make a sound map and hear from which direction what you hear. Draw a little sound map. Or try to taste the difference of trees. For many trees, you can eat the leaves or the needles, and then you can try it with closed eyes. Someone is feeding you with a leaf, for example, and you try to find out which species it is. That's very funny also with children. For children, it's always boring to have something like a biology lesson with their parents outside. But when you make things like this, taste a beech tree. Taste an oak, or make a sound map. That is very, very cool. And on the other hand, you sharpen your senses, and you have a lot of senses.
I love the idea of listening to the depth to the sound that comes out of these forests. And I take it that each forest produces its own music.
I've spoken a lot with blind people, and they say, there's one guy said he can say by the sound of the wind going through the crown of a tree which species it is. That's really cool. I'm not able to, but I would love to have the same ability.
What about the importance of bringing children into forests or into these nature-rich experiences?
I think it's very important to bring children into forest and bring in the children the right way. I think what's always cool with children is when it's an adventure for children. So not a lesson, not trying to teach children anything, but let them experience nature. And we do that a lot. For example, first when we walk in the forest, we let them shout very loud, because most people say, you have to be very silent, not to disturb the animals. But the animals are relaxing when children are loud. Why? Because then they know, these people are no hunters. And animals just fear hunters. Otherwise, you could come very close to them. And so, and children which are told to be silent don't like forests. So the first thing we do in the forest is to say to the children, shout as loud as you can.
That's great. For you, is there a type of tree or an experience you have with a tree that's particularly magical?
Every day. That's really
Yeah.
every day. I'm living here with my wife in an old forester house in the forest. And in the moment, I'm looking at an old birch tree. The tree is around about 19 years old. It's one of the 90 years old. It's one of the biggest birch trees I have ever seen. And it's in the inner, it's a little bit rotten. And every storm, I think, perhaps it's the last year, but it's so full of little wonders with birds nesting in it, and spiders and snails and lichens growing on it. And it's still strong and tough, and I'm always wonder what this tree is feeling, if it's a happy life or whatsoever. But yeah, I'm just admiring it.
And I take it you must be a fan of some of the incredible trees we have in California. I mean, the sequoias, for those that haven't been there, or the redwoods that I've mentioned, or the Joshua trees. This is a state that is blessed with many of these organisms.
Exactly. Yeah, and therefore I think we need to have more such wonders. We admire the biggest trees, me too, to be honest, because for example the oldest trees on earth, the oldest tree on earth is a spruce, which is around about 5 meters in height, that's not very impressive. But to see this giant redwoods, that's really wonderful. And when we see how old they can get and how they are working, and how they are filtering out the humidity from the air, then I think we should give them a little bit more room.
Well, lastly, touching on just questions of conservation into the future, you write a lot about new approaches to how to manage forests. What would you say in terms of what's coming next, or new practices you hope to spread across the globe?
Concerning the practice of forestry, I would say we need more letting nature doing the job. Mm. For example, if you plant a forest, it can never be as good as a forest which came by nature. Because when you plant a tree, you damage the root system. And the root system is the brain of the tree. And we know that this damage will never be healing the whole lifetime of the tree. So it gets more unstable, or in droughts, it will die earlier, and so on. So it's always better to let the forest come back itself. It's full of surprise, and it's not in every case that what you wanted or needed, but it's stronger. And you can harvest timber in such a forest in some decades or centuries, but more carefully and with more respect, and perhaps without those big machines which are destroying the soil, which is even more important because it stores water like a sponge for dry summers. Yeah, I would wish forestry which is more respectful.
Peter Wallibin is a forester and the author of The Hidden Life of Trees, What They Feel, How They Communicate. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you, Jonathan. It was really a pleasure.
We'll be back with Life Examined on KCRW after this short break.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Jonathan Bastian, back with Life Examined on KCRW. We just heard Peter Wallibin talk about the collaborative ways in which trees communicate with each other. He also suggested that taking a, quote, little daytime nap under a tree might be pretty good for your health. So can trees actually help us feel better, even heal? Do natural compounds released by trees lower blood pressure, ease depression, and increase cognitive function? To learn more, we're joined by Anna Ka'ahanui. She's a master naturalist and co-founder of Capital Nature, a nonprofit that encourages interaction with wild spaces. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Anna, just tell us why you love trees so much. Where does your deep fascination come from as you've spent so many years studying these amazing things?
You know, I'll tell you how it all began for me. It started with a leaf. I live in Northern Virginia, was walking my dog one day several years ago, and I saw this leaf. And I picked it up and just thought, well, how beautiful is this leaf? And why haven't I noticed these trees all around me that I've been walking on the trails for years? Mm. And so I got really excited, and I started looking at all the other trees and the different types of leaves, and I got sort of obsessed with studying them. So I decided to go through the coursework to become a Virginia Master Naturalist, where you learn all the different things about different aspects of nature, but trees were one of my favorites. I felt like trees were my friends. I became friends with them as I learned about them. I studied under several folks in the area. One of my mentors, her name is Melanie Chukas Bradley, has written a book called The City of Trees, and it's only a field guide of trees of the DC metro area. And so it's great stories and anecdotes, but also about the different species. And once I made that connection, I became inspired to connect others to it. Just the feeling that I got from being in the presence of trees and nature in general just really inspired me to just reach out and start changing my career so that I could help people connect to nature.
Mm. Talk about the feeling that you get. Go a little more into that. What comes over you? What do you feel in your body and your mind as you're surrounded by trees?
Absolutely. Well, I am a certified forest therapy guide. And so I've gone through a training with the Association of Nature and Forest Therapy Guides and Programs. And our whole purpose is to get people to slow down. That's something that in today's society, we are so busy running from place to place, errands, we're multitasking. And the whole purpose of to forest bathe or have forest therapy is to experience the forest with all of your senses. And so it's first slowing down, it's being present. It's listening to the sounds, it's tasting the air, it's feeling the textures of the barks and the leaves. And just there's this overwhelming sort of calmness and well-being that I get when I'm among trees. I just feel like I'm among friends, that I, when I walk through a forest, I feel like I'm sort of walking into sort of a kind of like a warm hug. I kind of feel like I'm being hugged by the trees. And I've even named some of the trees in my neighborhood. There's Manny the musclewood tree or Mo the tulip poplar. And it just, I just feel their presence. I feel their being. And I feel a connectedness and a closeness to them that just gives me, you know, just a lot of, it gives me a lot of joy.
And can you talk about the power of smelling trees? Might sound kind of funny to say, but there's something very therapeutic in that on a biological level, isn't there?
Absolutely. So when folks in the mid-80s in Japan were realizing their Ministry of Health realized that their people were so stressed out and their chronic disease was high, suicide levels were high. So they decided to do some studies about people's exposure in nature and how it can affect them both physically and mentally. And what they discovered is that trees emit organic compounds called phytoncides. And they're actually a defense mechanism and a communication method for plants and trees. But what they tested and realized was that when humans ingest or inhale these phytoncides, these organic compounds, it gives us tremendous benefit. It can lower cortisol levels, which is the stress hormone. It can relax you. You can have better creativity. And your blood pressure can go down. And so many, and they also increase the production of NK or natural killer cells, which are cancer fighting cells. So just, I mean, it's proven, science has proven it, that the benefits that we get just by taking a walk in the forest are great. And it doesn't just last for that one walk. It could last for weeks after that as well.
Are there any memories that you have of bringing folks into forests that you'd want to share with us or people that stick out in your memory?
Absolutely. I actually gave a forest bathing walk for a group of gentlemen in Washington, D.C. a few weeks ago. Their daily work is with a nonprofit in D.C. called Ward 8 Woods. It is a nonprofit that goes in and cleans up the forest, pulls out trash and invasive species. And their day-to-day work is rugged and hard. And their executive director, my friend Nathan Harrington, he said, you know, I think I'd like my team to experience forest bathing. And we did this wonderful walk with these gentlemen in a very DC area, just right across the street from one of the metro stops, but deep into a forest, we were able to walk in. I found a clearing where we were able to sit and listen to the sounds. And I have people, when we get in touch with our senses, I have them close their eyes and listen to the sounds. And one of the gentlemen said afterwards that, you know, nature sounds so much more beautiful with your eyes closed. Mm. And to have him have that realization after, you know, experience nature in a different way was very powerful. And another exercise I do is something called deer ears, where you stand with your back to running water and cup your ears towards the water, and it amplifies the sound tremendously. And when we did this exercise with the gentleman, one gentleman actually, he was so taken, he actually got down on his knees because he couldn't believe what he was hearing just by putting his hands up to his ears to listening to the water and how therapeutic it was. Mm-hmm. So you'd be just really amazed what you will feel and experience if you just give yourself that time to be present in that moment in the forest.
Do you think that humans, whether it's going back to ancestors or indigenous cultures, I mean, that they shared some form of a sacred or spiritual relationship to trees?
Absolutely. You know, even in my Hawaiian culture, you know, the relationship of the people to the trees and the stewardship and the protection and I think that many cultures, you know, consider trees as members of their family, as part of the community, you know, not this other being, but the sort of creation, sort of as a oneness, as all together. And so, and we know with the Native Americans, you know, they had so many great uses for trees. As part of my nonprofit here in DC, we have Capital Nature. We do these education programs. And when we have experts talk about the trees and their properties, it's amazing to hear all the different types of things and parts of trees that could be used for different things in the different indigenous communities.
I wonder if you could recall any of those or any really interesting medicinal uses of trees that might surprise us.
You know, what was really interesting is I feel like so many of the different remedies were for stomach ailments and eating things and sore throats and things like that. And it's just, you know, here's a good example. I was participating in a global nature citizen science event a few weeks ago called the City Nature Challenge. And that was happening in 414 cities around the world. And I was making some observations with my iNaturalist app on my phone. And somehow I brushed myself and scratched myself on my wrist, and I was bleeding. Mm. And my friend that was with me said, do you know that these plantain leaves here, so there are these little wild plantain plants, not like the ones that we eat with the fruits, but little weeds, basically, but a type of plantain. And so he instructed me to take that plantain leaf, brush off the dust, brush off the dirt, stick it in my mouth to wetten it, and then stick it on my wound. And it was it was nature's Band-Aid, and it worked wonderfully. It stuck to my wound, which was a small wound, but it stopped the bleeding. And to me, that was just like a really great example of just how, you know, when you need something, nature's right there and it has your back.
Yeah, that's a wonderful story. How do you feel about the difference between these beautiful old growth forests around us and maybe the tree that sprouts in the middle of a very dense concrete neighborhood? Are they the same thing? Are they different? Should we interact with them differently? What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. One of the activities that we did for Capital Nature in the fall was we led urban street tree walks. And so there is an organization in DC called KC Trees, and they have worked with the DC Department of Transportation, their forestry division, to make a really awesome online map of all the trees in DC. And KC Trees is their mission is to protect the forest canopy of the DC area. And so I with my colleague Stella Tarney, we did some research on three different blocks in an old section of DC, where we found maybe 77 different species of trees that were planted on three blocks, and basically researched them and then led a walking tour for local residents on these trees and just how amazing they are, right? You know, right here in our presence. And so many people just walk by them. You know, they don't know their significance. They don't know their history. They don't know their different seeds and their different flowers and things like that. And so we really, really, really enjoy introducing people to things that are right in front of them that they wouldn't necessarily notice.
Mm. Do you think that trees should be considered a very viable approach to certain aspects of climate change or, you know, the urban heat island effects, ways to cool down neighborhoods as well?
Absolutely. My day job is at the U.S. Green Building Council. We're a nonprofit that promotes sustainability and green building. And so I learned from the start that the heat island effect, so important when you look at the temperatures that the trees are able to help bring city temperatures down. And also with green roofs, I mean, more and more, you know, buildings are covering themselves with green roofs, not only for stormwater management to mitigate that, but also to cool their buildings so that they don't have to spend as much on the cooling of their building. And so definitely, when we see all this forestry lost in the Amazon with the fires and such, and all that devastation, yes, that's definitely going to have a massive effect on dealing with climate change. And so I think a lot of people realize that the more trees we plant, the better off we'll be. And so just because they do so much for us, not only mentally, but even just ecologically, they definitely are a great benefit to helping mitigate that.
I wonder what you would instruct us Californians in terms of, you know, when it comes to these incredible wildfires that rip across our state. And we hear stories of the sequoias burning And it's hard to sit with sometimes as you see these beautiful giants just slowly start to burn. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, but it's something I think a lot of people in the state are sitting with and dealing with.
Absolutely. One of the things that I learned in my Master Naturalist coursework was that burning of tree areas and meadows and such is a natural process that kind of helps with a rebirth. Mm. And so while devastating as it is, forests are resilient. And so after an act of a fire, things rise up from the ashes, you know, kind of like a phoenix, you know, and start anew. And nature is kind of programmed to do that. And so that's the only sort of glimmer of hope that I see from the forest fires is that the possibilities of what's going to come next and what's going to come up and grow after those fires.
Well, as we begin to wrap up our conversation, I wonder if you have a favorite tree or a favorite species, and you could tell us about why it's so beautiful and fascinating.
Sure, absolutely. I have a couple based on properties. And so for bark, I really love the musselwood tree. The musselwood tree, I think it's Carpus caroliniana, Carpinus caroliniana. Its bark is, it's almost like carved sculpture. When you touch it, it looks like the rippled muscles, you know, of skin. And I find that very, very fascinating. Mm. In terms of leaves, I'm a huge lover of the ginkgo tree leaves. They give me so much joy. I have two in my neighborhood. They are the most ancient species. They've been around, you know, forever. And I love those. And then the sycamore bark, which is the mottled one that kind of looks speckled like camouflage. I love those. And then of course, being from Hawaii, the koa tree, is very near and dear to my heart. It's just beautiful. It evokes so many childhood memories for me. It's a very revered tree in the Hawaiian culture. And so when I think about trees back home, I think about the koa tree.
We've been speaking here with Ana Ka'ahanui, a lover and expert of trees. We thank you so much for the time today.
Thank you so much for having me, Jonathan.
Once again, that was Ana Ka'ahanui, a master naturalist and co-founder of Capital Nature. Well, that's all for today. The producer of Life Examined is Andrea Brody. You can listen to this and all other episodes on your favorite podcasting app. And if you like what you hear, we'd love to read your review. You can also find us at kcrw.org/lifeexamined. I'm Jonathan Bastian. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week.